I'm what is laughingly known as an actor, but I see it more as being a communicator. I think that's what acting is about. It's about communicating, and in order to do that, it's about listening.
Jeremy Irons is on the London stage as I record this. He's starring in Long Day's Journey Into Night, that Eugene O'Neill masterpiece of a play about a family's secrets and self-destruction. The show's heading next to New York and then L.A., but if you're not in any of those cities, you can just go to a movie theater to see Jeremy Irons on screen in Red Sparrow.
Your only problem is you have a soul.
It's his first spy movie, which is saying something because Jeremy Irons has made more than 60 movies, including The French Lieutenant's Woman, Betrayal, The Mission, Reversal of Fortune, Kafka, Damage, The Lion King, Lolita, The Man in the Iron Mask, The Merchant of Venice, Beautiful Creatures, The Man Who Knew Infinity. I could go on and on, but I'm running out of breath. For 40 years, Jeremy Irons has been one of the hardest working, best loved actors on stage, on television, and in the movies. And he's the star of this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam May, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Let's go back to the beginning, or almost the beginning, just before Jeremy Irons had his first taste of acting. To set the stage, Irons was born in 1948, and he went to boarding school about 10 miles from home. Home was the Isle of Wight in the English Channel, just off the coast of Southampton.
An island off an island, and a trip to the mainland was a big event and happened maybe once a year. Although now you can get across in a speedboat in 7 minutes. But then it was a long way away. And I was brought up in a house that was a converted stable block, with a garden leading into a field, leading into a wood that led to the harbour, where we would keep three boats. So in the holidays, when I was back from my boarding school, I would ride ponies, which suited me because my taste was and still is to go off in a solitary manner with something I can communicate with, whether it be a boat, a dog, or a horse. So I would do that, either sail or ride the horses. It was an idyllic childhood. Mm.
Jeremy Irons spoke with the Academy of Achievement in London in 2000, though he's been a guest and a speaker at the Academy's summits many times since, most recently accompanied by his gorgeously scruffy rescue dog, Smudge. Smudge Irons, naturally, has his own Twitter feed, as do we. It's hashtag WhatItTakesPod. You can follow us there or on Facebook or Instagram. But I digress. When Jeremy Irons sat to record this conversation about his life with Mark Pachter for the Academy of Achievement, he talked a bit about his father, an accountant, and his mother, who'd been an ambulance driver in World War II but stayed home to raise the kids after that. And he described how his parents divorced when he was 15. He was away still at school then, not a brilliant student by any means.
Not naturally intellectual or a natural swot.
That's British slang for a student who keeps their nose to the grindstone.
Somebody whose interest had to be whetted. Still the same, still the case. And sadly, because I was in the youngest stream and not that bright, I was actually in the lowest, or almost the lowest stream, which attracted the least interesting teachers. And I'm never one for blaming others, but I wish I had found someone who had introduced me to the joy of learning for learning's sake, and I never did. So I continued through my next school, which takes me up to the age of 17, moving from the bottom stream of 1 year into the bottom stream, or maybe even a lower stream in the next year, all the way through. I showed other talents, which gave me self-respect, which was fine. I captained the Ragga 15, and I did very well in the CCF, which we call the Corps, which is military training, officer training, which we used to do, which they did now, I think, only do on a voluntary basis, but everybody used to have to do it. And what that allowed me to do was to have enormous fun. And like anything that you do with great enthusiasm, you do well in it. And I became the top rank you could become, which is a regimental sergeant major in that. And when I came to leave, I'd also done one play, and I'd also played the violin. I was in the orchestra and enjoyed that. I'd done one play. I'd always wanted to do more plays, but I never quite understood how you got asked to do a play. I'd done house plays, but they were sort of skits, but the main school play. And I'd assumed that someone would see you walking about and thinking, he speaks like an angel and looks like a god, let's have him on our play, but nobody ever did. So I waited and waited until my final year when I was taking my A-levels, which if I did well in them would allow me to go for university entrance. Yeah. And somebody thought, well, he doesn't speak like an angel or look like a god, but actually we need him, and asked me to do a play, The Critic by Sheridan. And I was overjoyed. I said, yes, I wish you'd asked me before. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'd love to have done a play sort of years ago. And he said, well, did you put your name on the list? And I said, which list? He said, well, in the cloisters, at the beginning of each autumn term, there's a list of boys who want to be in the play. I said, is there? I've been at the school for 4 years. This tells you something about my inquiring mind. However, I did the play. I succeeded on sort of chutzpah and charm. No technique at all, didn't know what I was doing, but it worked. I think I was always, looking back at my school days, I was always finding ways to be different. I think I've always had, and I don't think it's an arrogance or a self... I don't think it's a bad thing, but I've always had a very strong sense of self. And whenever I'm in a situation where I'm wearing the same as 600 other people and doing the same thing as 600 other people, looking back, I always found ways to make myself different, whether it be having a red lining in the side of my jacket, having red shoes, it hasn't changed, having the only bicycle which could fold in half and be dropped from a parachute, having the only Macintosh which was a raincoat in this country, which was shiny and black and three-quarter length. Just various things, looking through my school days, having the only farm nearby where I could go and smoke and drink beer on a weekend without
surely
anybody
not.
Knowing. Surely not. But nobody else had that organized. So there was I found a way through keeping my own sense of self. And I think when I came to do the play, it was a sort of another way of saying, I am I.
The theater's gain, but veterinary medicine's loss. Irons was seriously considering a career as a veterinarian, but he wasn't good at science and didn't qualify for university. So off to London it was, where he harbored hopes for a life in the theater, but in the meantime ran a youth group for the Church of England. For extra cash, he played guitar on the streets for people waiting in line at the movies. Eventually, he saw a help wanted ad in the newspaper. A repertory theater in Canterbury was looking for an assistant stage manager, and he got the job.
Small wage, but just enough to get by on. And I made props, and I walked on, and I changed scenery, and I realized that I just loved it. Not the acting, I wasn't acting. I liked the theater, I liked the people, I liked the time that we worked. I now looking back, I see what I was doing. But at the time, I didn't know. You never know at the time. What I was doing was finding a way not to have to be stuck with any of the sort of people I've been educated with, but finding a way of creating the life of a gypsy, really, of being able to move from camp to camp, singing around the fire, getting to know those people, and then moving on, maybe with some of them, or maybe not, to another place, but never being... I think I was educated always... A career seemed to me something rather like a prison sentence. That was how I viewed a career. That I would start at the bottom, I'd work my way up the ladder, and then I'd retire, and after a little bit, I'd die. And I thought, there's nothing I want to do like that, really. Nothing I want to do enough. But I'd like to... I'd read a lot of autobiographies of actors, from Burbage, Shakespeare's leading man, through to Charlie Chaplin, Noel Coward, and all the people in between. That was while I was at school, under the notion that I was collecting them, but with no knowledge as to why. But in fact, a lot was, you know, you don't collect things without a reason. And a lot of their lives soaked into me and their attitudes. And to be an outsider seemed to me to be very, very attractive. So.
And being an outsider is what an actor is.
I think so. Not always. But for me, I see an actor being, they are privileged in that they can, at their best, stand beside the king's ear and tell him, you ain't got no clothes on, chummy, and get away with it.
When actors get knighted, Jeremy Irons said, he always worries that they're becoming co-opted by the establishment. Stay away, he warned. Keep behaving badly and stirring the mud. It's an idea you'll hear him talk more about in a speech we'll play at the end of the episode. For Irons, being a rogue and a vagabond was the very point of becoming an actor.
And yet, it's given me so much more than that. I mean, it's allowed me to go on great journeys into other people, which I enjoy. I have a very blinkered mentality. I tend to... good things and bad things about that. I tend to see what I'm after and go for it, and everything else doesn't exist, which is very useful when you're creating a character or when you're acting in front of a camera with 100 people, you know. It's quite difficult for those who live with you, who suddenly don't exist, like your wife or your children or your secretary, you know. But they're used to it now. They know that when I'm working, I'm, you know, that's pure, that's... It's also very good, I have to say, when you're deciding what to go for. You know, I've always said to people, you've got to know what number you're trying to get on the dartboard. Get that number and throw the dart at that.
When Jeremy Irons decided that the number on his dartboard was acting, in other words, he took precise aim and went for the bullseye. So to back up just a bit, he was working backstage at a rep theater and loving it when he realized that to be on stage rather than backstage, he would need to go to drama school. So he enrolled in England's prestigious Bristol Old Vic Theatre School.
Now, my theatre training, I showed no aptitude at all. Funnily enough, 4 nights ago, I had dinner with 3 other colleagues who were at theatre with me. Tim Pickett-Smith, who was in Jewel in the Crown, I don't know whether you saw that. He had always thought I would give up very quickly, like in a year or 2 years after leaving drama school. He said, you had no talent.
You had no talent?
No. And I didn't. I wore clothes well. I decorated the stage well. But I wasn't an actor in the way that Tim was, or many of the other students. But as I say, in the 2 years, I learned various skills. I learned a little bit about the theatre, about styles, about... how to speak, how to stand, how to sing. Sing not using my nose like Bob Dylan, but actually sing using my diaphragm. And at the end of the 2 years, 5 of us were chosen to go down into the theatre. Went down there for 3 years. I outlived them all. I stayed on, and I finished off playing the juvenile leads very badly. And by then I decided, and I suppose this is one talent I do have, is that I know my direction, usually. And I knew that I didn't want to keep being a repertory actor. Repertory actors move around from town to town, repertory theatre to repertory theatre, and do maybe 6 month contracts. But they don't earn very much. And I knew that I was too middle class, that I wanted a family, I wanted a house, I wanted a mortgage. And I knew I wouldn't be able to afford one doing that. So I thought, I have to go to London. I have to go to London and do a West End show or a film. So I came to London. And to live, I thought, I need something to live because I don't want to have to take a job because I need the money. So I worked for a domestics agency which cleaned houses and sometimes did up people's gardens. Because I had a car, I was quite reliable because I could turn up, and so they used to use me quite a lot. And I did that and auditioned for everything because I hated auditioning, found it very difficult, and thought, well, I better get good at this. So I just kept doing auditions, and if I was offered the job, I'd say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm sorry, I thought I could do it, which is why I came to the audition, but I can't do that. And eventually I did an audition for an American show called Godspell, which was coming to be launched in London. And despite my height, because Americans enjoy uniformity in a way that the British don't, they wanted everybody of a sort of nice chorus line height, and there was this person who was a good 3 inches taller than anyone else. And every time I sort of slouched, a little voice would say, stand up, Jeremy, could you be? So I thought, oh, crap. Anyway, they gave me the job.
It wasn't easy to find that recording, folks, but that is Jeremy Irons on the London stage in Godspell in 1971.
And I did that for 2 years in the West End, or about a year and a half. No, 2 years. And I remember one night sitting on the stage during a song. Someone else was singing a song. I was sitting at one side. David Essex, who played Jesus, was sitting on the other. I played John the Baptist and Judas. And I thought, you know, I slipped these shoes on, these theatrical shoes on, without a lot of thought, but they fit me like kid gloves. And I have something to offer. But I still gave myself to the age of 30. I said, at 30, I think I could change careers. Much after that, it would be difficult. So let's see how I'm doing then.
By 30, this was 5 or 6 years later, Jeremy Irons was doing quite well, thank you very much. He'd secured his status as a leading man on stage in The Taming of the Shrew and Much Ado About Nothing, and he'd been directed by the famous playwright Harold Pinter in a play called The Rear Column. By 30, Irons had also starred in a TV series written by Harold Pinter for the BBC. He played the romantic lead opposite Judi Dench before she became Dame Judi Dench. And there were other television roles as well. Movies were still ahead for Jeremy Irons, just around the corner, actually. But at 30, he had reached the goals he set for himself. Happiness? Check. Success? Check. Marriage, money, and a life he could be proud of? Check, check, check. And then, Irons got into a dispute that threatened to end his acting career, just as it was taking off into the stratosphere. A contract dispute during the shooting of the television series Brideshead Revisited.
Through complicated reasons, there had been a strike of the technicians and our schedule had been shifted. I had also been asked by a director called Carol Rice to make a film called The French Lieutenant's Woman in the March of that year, when Brideshead should have been finished. When we came back together to make Brideshead after the strike, we'd been delayed by, I think, 2 or 3 months. And we could see that the schedule was going to have to be even longer anyway because of getting to Oxford for the locations and various other things. And I said to my producer, when he rang me up and said, would you restart on Brideshead? And I said, well, of course I would, but I have to tell him in March, I told Carol that I'll do this movie. He said, oh, that's fine, we'll work that out. Well, when the time came to work it out, I got a rather heavy message from the television company saying, I'm sorry, we can't release you. We need to work through that period. And a lot of people were, you know, involved in that. And I thought, wait a minute, I have a contract. No, I don't have a contract. I actually hadn't signed the contract. But I have a verbal contract with my producer. He understood what I'd said. So I went to see a lawyer. We were filming up north. I came down to London. And he was good, it was silk. And he said, you'd win if what you tell me is true. But it would take a year and a half to come to court. I said, well, that's hopeless, isn't it? I mean, you know, we'll be finished by then. The film will have gone. So I went back north to work, leaving an agent in tears in London. And after one day's work, went back to my hotel room and thought, you're being very British about this, Jeremy, you're 30. If you're going to make it in this life, you're going to make it in your 30s. And you think you're right, and you're stepping down because you've been told you can't win in court. If that's the way you're going to manage your life, then fine, but don't expect too much. So I sat down, I had a couple of martinis and dinner, and then returned to my room and wrote a long letter to the chairman of the television company, telling him that I was off, unless by 6 o'clock the following day, he would agree to release me to make this film. And I laid out, I knew everything he could do to me. I said, I know you can bar me from the union. I know you can sue me. They by then spent 8 million, I think. I said, my house is worth 85,000. That's about all I have. But you can sue me for that. I'm not an hysterical actor. I'm just an actor against the wall. And that is, you know. I called my lawyer first thing in the morning and read it over the phone to him and said, that's what I want to send. He said, if you're absolutely sure, you seem to know the downside. I said, yeah. He said, all right, I will fax it to me and I'll have it delivered round, which he did. By 6 o'clock that day, there'd been no response. So having checked with my producer whether there'd been any response, and he said, no, there hadn't. I got in my car, drove down to London, went out to a film premiere. The following day, I was fairly shaky because walking off a set in this country is a big thing, I think in America too. And a lot of people were beholden to me. I was a big cast, big crew, all of this. And I was gone, and I was in every scene for, I think, 2 weeks. I went to lunch with my agent in a restaurant. There was a phone call during lunch from the chairman of the television company who said, will you come for tea? I said, yeah. I asked my agent for a Valium, went to walk the dog on Hampstead Heath, and then went down to have tea with the chairman of Granada, who was very cross, said he felt let down. I said, I feel let down. We're both in the same boat. He said, if I can work something out, will you go back to work? I said, certainly, I'll be back there tomorrow morning. He left the room for about 15 minutes, came back in and said, I'll work this out in 3 weeks. Give me 3 weeks. So I went back to work. 3 weeks later, they tied the two things together, the film and the television, so that the film paid for the downtime of the television and the television invested in the film. And I was able to do both. But on the journey down, the night before, when I'd driven down in my Volkswagen Beetle, long drive on the M6, about 4 hour drive, I remember thinking, that's it, that is it. Now, if I'm not going to act, what am I going to do? I could be an agent, but should I write? Well, can I write? I don't know, but I knew that was it. And I knew that I had taken my destiny in my hand in a way that I had never felt before. And I think that's when I grew up. I knew I was my own man. I could do anything.
The two conflicting projects in Conflict No More ended up being released internationally within months of each other, and they were both hugely popular. Jeremy Irons was suddenly a household name. The fame was a little overwhelming, but the work, it just came happily cascading in. Over the next decade, he starred in at least 13 movies and 4 major theater productions, and the pace has not slowed since. During all that time, Jeremy Irons says he has carried with him lessons he learned from playing John the Baptist in Godspell.
Godspell was a good leap for me. It was a good shot window. And although it pulled things out of my nature that weren't particularly good, in that I have a sort of insecurity and a desire for perfection which when mixed is somewhat volatile. Mm. So what I was able to do with that show, there were 10 of us, is we all developed into a very frank group, and we could speak eye to eye with people and say, what you're doing there is rubbish. We've got to do better than that. That's terrible. It's lazy. It's, you know. And we finally were able to talk to each other like this. I've always tried since then, whenever I work with people, to speak like that. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, especially now when I'm working with film stars who are equally sensitive about their talent and about, you know, what they can give. And who, I think in the American tradition, it's probably because American actors don't come out of company theatre in quite the same way that English actors do. There is more a defensiveness, a pugnaciousness towards each other. A good performance to an American actor would be a threat. For me, it's joy, because I know that if I'm to play tennis, if I play with Ivan Lendl, my game is going to look better than I play with my mother. So the better my partner or my opposition, however you like to think about it, the better my game. I love that, and I feed off that. And sometimes I have relationships with actors where that happens. Glenn Close and I have worked a lot together, and we are always keeping each other on our toes, saying it's got to be better than that. You know, that's not the answer. And I think many good actors are like that. Meryl Streep, she's very frank with me, and I'm able to be frank with her. Now, that is difficult for some people, and as a result, with that desire to get things as good as possible, I would say that I'm probably regarded as quite prickly to work with.
Well, he said it first, so luckily I don't need to touch that. It's interesting that Irons mentioned both Glenn Close and Meryl Streep, because the work he did with each of them was some of the most transformative of his career. Streep was his co-star in The French Lieutenant's Woman. It came early in her career, too, but she was already a well-known film actress. Irons was recommended to play the part of her lover by the film's screenwriter, a certain Harold Pinter, who you recall had worked with Irons several years before.
You told me you loved me. You showed me your love. Answer me!
There was madness in me at that time. A bitterness, an envy. I forced myself on you, knowing that you had other obligations. It was unworthy. I suddenly saw, after you had gone, that I had to destroy what had begun between us.
Are you saying that you never loved me?
I could not say that.
But you must say that. You must say I am totally evil. I used him as an instrument. That I do not care that in all this time he hasn't seen a woman to compare with me. That his life has been a desert without me. That he has sacrificed everything for me. Say it!
Glenn Close was Jeremy Irons' co-star on Broadway in 1984 in Tom Stoppard's play The Real Thing. It was Irons' New York theater debut, and he won a Tony Award for it. Several years later, Glenn Close convinced him to join her on the film Reversal of Fortune, a true story about the notorious Von Bülow murder case. That role won Jeremy Irons an Academy Award.
What I wanted to ask, if we lose the appeal, will I have the chance later to set my affairs in order before I'm incarcerated? In Europe, a gentleman is given the opportunity to end things properly.
Jeremy Irons and Glenn Close and Meryl Streep, by the way, were all united in the film The House of the Spirits, based on Isabel Allende's novel. With such a string of successes, the interviewer here wanted to know whether Jeremy Irons had ever felt unable to capture a character he'd been hired to play, or whether it always eventually came with enough hard work.
I don't believe in hard work. If something's hard, leave it. Let it come to you, let it happen. Now, the decision to play a role is halfway towards understanding the character, because you empathize with it, that's why you want to play it. I think I would not be described as a character actor in that I don't take on characteristics which are very alien to me. I sometimes put on things like when I play Klaus von Bülow, I change the way I look and the way I sound because that man was living and I had to make some attempt to look and sound like him. But let us take him. My chief desire when I played him, and I was not keen to play him because he was still alive, and I felt that was somehow rather tasteless. Mm-hmm. But of course, I realized that if I didn't, someone else would. So I thought, well, he's going to have to suffer this. But I couldn't get my head round him at all. And I had, what evidence? I had two interviews he gave, one with Barbara Walters and one with somebody else, on video, which I watched and watched and watched. Just to sort of try to, not to be like him, but to try to understand him. I read his court journals. I looked at the photographs of him, many as I could find, and couldn't get inside him at all until I suddenly thought, now, wait a minute. My father was an honorable man. If he had either done or been accused of doing what Klaus, which perhaps could have happened, how would he deal with it if he was interviewed on Barbara Walters? He'd probably deal with it rather like Klaus. He'd use charm, and he'd use a sort of English reserve. But I'm very like my father. Mm. So maybe, and that was my way inside him. Mm. As far as what can't one get round, or what one can't get round, a lot of those roles aren't offered to you. Because the sad thing about, I suppose, any business, but mine, you see it particularly, is that you're always asked to do what you've done. If you're successful in a sort of role, when people read another role that's rather similar, they think, ask him, he's the man. You read him and say, but I've done this. I did this with this guy, I don't want to do this. So, nevertheless, what I'm saying is that one's parameters are constantly narrowed by one's success. And my desire is to widen my field, even if I risk failure. The risk of failure and daring failure, I think, is another great way towards success. What I try to do as an actor is constantly find ways to risk, find opportunities to fall on my face, if it's going to be worth it. And then maybe I'll surprise myself. Mm. But what I'm being offered as an actor, because I'm now successful, I'm now known, is more and more of the same. And when people know me, for instance, they say, why don't you do more comedies? And I say, because on film I look quite serious, and because I have a reputation for being able to provide an interior life and all that sort of thing.
A gravitas.
That's right. And yet I'm sure that Steve Martin, you know, would love to be where I am, and I would like to be maybe more where he is as far as the comedy stakes are concerned. So certain roles are not offered.
Funny enough, 9 years after this interview, Jeremy Irons had a supporting role in Pink Panther 2, starring Steve Martin as Inspector Clouseau. Irons played the first suspect interrogated by Clouseau's incompetent detective colleagues.
Look, I know my answers are less than satisfactory. I realize that. Does this mean I must spend the rest of my life living under a cloud of suspicion?
Forgive my intrusion.
Oh, yes.
There is one way to prove your innocence. Back in 1996, while perpetrating a crime...
Yes, yes, yes. He received a bullet wound in the shoulder. Is this what it's come to? That I must strip down and remove my clothes in the sanctity of my own home before a group of people I've only just met just to prove my innocence?
Well, it wouldn't hurt.
Pink Panther 2 aside, Jeremy Irons is certainly right. Comedy roles have eluded him. But what a rich array of characters he has inhabited over his 5 decades as an actor. He's been a Polish immigrant in Moonlighting, an 18th century priest in the mission, a swashbuckling musketeer in The Man in the Iron Mask, an obsessive pedophile in Lolita, a magical dragon rider in Aragon, a famous mathematician in The Man Who Knew Infinity. He's been plenty of debonair, seductive men, and plenty of glorious villains, too. Jeremy Irons says that the risks he's taken as an actor throughout his career have resulted in plenty of failures, no matter whether the audience would agree or not.
I constantly experience failure in that my work is never as good as I want it to be. So I live with failure. What buoys you up are the people who you have deceived, who think you're great and congratulate you on things. And you think, because you know there is no good or bad, basically. And that gives you comfort when you read terrible reviews. I did a play in Stratford. I did a season in Stratford, and I opened with Leontes in The Winter's Tale, who has to be one of Shakespeare's hardest, I think. I always feel that he said to Burbage after he'd played Othello, right, you've done jealousy, now I'm going to give you jealousy with no reason, just play it, come on and play it. And I'd been off filming maybe for too long, and I came back and I didn't have the wherewithal to embrace him in time for the critics. So I got pretty mauled doing that, and I thought, well, great, I've got time to learn. But one also knows that for 10 people who've disliked something that you've done, whether it be a film or a play, there will always be 10 who like it. And the great antidote for my business is that most people, being fine-natured, will tell you that they've enjoyed something. If they haven't enjoyed it, they don't tell you. So that you tend to be sort of cotton-wooled as an actor from the actual truth. But I know, looking at my work, I think I know the true value of it, which is usually about 40% of what I'd hoped I would achieve, which is fine. It gives me something to go, you know, try to learn, to improve. But I do think it's terribly important. And I live in a world where one is constantly being misled, either by the length of one's limo or the size of one's face on the screen, or the kind remarks of people that surround you. And I know that they are constantly telling you lies about the true nature of what you do. I think that's very important, because when I work on the screen or work on the stage, if I'm not in touch with truth, my true self, my true feelings, the true importance or non-importance of what this skinny 6'1" frame is about, then I'm lost. I can't, how can I, you know, I mean, that's, I'm an instrument. I'm hopefully a Stradivarius, but maybe a lesser make. But if the sound I make is not pure, if it's been misled by a misunderstanding of one's importance in life, then you're in trouble, I think.
That brings me to the conclusion of Jeremy Irons' interview. But as promised, there's a part two. The speech he made to inspire students and young leaders at the Academy of Achievement Summit in Dublin in 2002. A speech where he shared his views about the importance of the arts. After droll and self-deprecating opening remarks, Jeremy Irons dove into the topic in earnest.
What do the arts, what relevance do they have with what's going on around us? Do the arts have an importance in today's world situation? Well, I think they do. I suppose you'd expect me to say that because I'm in the arts. But I believe that we have a role in the bringing together of communal hopes, dreams, and fears in the way we tell our stories. You may think that we waste the opportunity for that, and I'll come on to that later. The arts allow us time to relax and sometimes to understand more about other people's situations. But you see, I believe the arts should be difficult and anti-establishment. If I was organized, and I keep telling my secretary this, that it's her fault, but if I was organized, I would know where this quote came from. But I don't. It sits in my study, opposite my desk in Ireland, where I have a house, and I'll read it to you because I think it's a wonderful quote, and I hope that if anybody at the end of it, wait till the end, do me a favour, wait till the end, and at the end of the quote, rather, which is a long quote, if you recognise it, hold up your hand and tell me who said it.
I'm going to interrupt here just to let you know that the quote is by poet Ezra Pound.
If an artist falsifies his report as to the nature of man, as to his own nature, as to the nature of his ideal of the perfect, if the artist falsifies his report on these matters or on any other matter in order that he may conform to the taste of his time, to the properties of a sovereign, to the conveniences of a preconceived code of ethics, then that artist lies. If he lies out of deliberate will to lie, if he lies out of carelessness, out of laziness, out of cowardice, out of any sort of negligence whatsoever, he nevertheless lies. And he should be punished or despised in proportion to the seriousness of his offence. Now, what to me that means is that one should, basically as an artist, be anti-establishment, to be anti-social. One should kick the shit. I like to think of the artist, be the musician, the painter, the writer, the actor, whatever, the playwright, as being the court jester sitting beside the king's throne. He's good-natured, he's ridiculously dressed, sometimes with a silly hat with balls on, carrying a rubber scepter. Now and again, the king kicks him down the steps, and he gets up laughing. But beneath the grease paint, I believe he has a deadly serious motive. He's there to remind the king and his courtiers, equally foolishly dressed, of their common frailty and mortality. Art, if it is to fulfill its true function, should seek to report and lay bare our true condition, however unpalatable that might be. And let us be under no misapprehension. Art can be tremendously powerful, not just on a personal level, reminding us of our shared humanity, but as an instrument of social change. What is political correctness but self-censorship? And the first step down the slippery slope where dissent and opposition to the status quo are seen as unwelcome and destructive. That slope, I believe, leads to dictatorship and totalitarianism. In totalitarian regimes, writers are imprisoned, plays are censored, and artists whose vision does not complement the ideals of those in power do not get their work shown. So if the arts can be feared, they must have power, a power to encourage people towards social change. I remember in Prague, I went there just as the wall came down, and all my fellow actors in the theatre said, the houses have gone. No audience. We're getting no audiences now. When the curtain was up, we were the way of communication. People would come and we would experiment with political ideas across the footlights. Now we have freedom. We don't need to, because this can be spoken in Parliament. This can be spoken in the streets. So in repressive regimes, the arts can be powerful. It seems only governments who lose confidence in themselves begin to fear and censor the arts. But censorship can come in many, many and more subtle forms. The danger for television and film, the so-called mass media, is that it's owned by large corporations, whose interest is to sustain the status quo and to encourage us to buy more, to want more, and not to rock the boat. So much that is made by the big studios becomes more and more pap for the masses, if you like. Yet, it does entertain us, often brilliantly, but it can reinforce our prejudices rather than making us question our beliefs. Of course, we should never forget, and I don't forget, the great work that people like Showtime, HBO, the Discovery Channel are doing to open our eyes to our situation, to the world around us, to foreign lands, and to times past. But the arts, film in particular, could do much, much more. It saddens me we get so little opportunity to see the films I see in Cannes. I was on the jury 3 years ago or so. I saw films from Turkey, from Iran, from China. I'm sorry that so few of us are able to see work from filmmakers around the world. Because the days should be past when other nations' differences make us either amazed, amused, or fearful. Our global cultural diversity should be understood, respected, and gloried in. When we learn that, surprisingly perhaps, not everybody wants what we want, or even what we think they should want. I think film, if used properly, and the arts in general, can break down the prejudice and the non-comprehension of other cultures by allowing us an understanding of our fellow men and his perception of how life should be lived. Not ours about how he should live it, but his. And if we respect each other, then possibly we can peacefully coexist as a world. So, don't dismiss the arts as the icing on the cake. It could be the yeast that makes the dough rise.
That's Jeremy Irons speaking in 2002. He's one of only 23 actors to have ever won an Oscar, a Tony, and an Emmy, the triple crown of acting. On our next episode, we keep the theater theme going with Tony Award-winning director Bartlett Scheer. This is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
I know that your powers of retention are as wet as a warthog's backside, but thick as you are, pay attention. My words are a matter of pride. It's clear from your vacant...
You can find all our episodes on iTunes and Spotify and wherever you find great audio. What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. We thank them, and we thank you for listening.
So prepare for the chance of a lifetime. Be prepared for sensational news. A shining new era is tiptoeing nearer.
And where do we feature?
Just listen to teacher. I know it sounds sordid, but you'll be rewarded when at last I am given my dues. And injustice deliciously square. Be prepared.
Yeah, be prepared. We'll be prepared. For what?
For the death of the king.
Why, is he sick?
No, fool, we're gonna kill him. Simba, too.